Strange. Punks and Drunks and Flicks and Kicks. Written and read by Richard Strange. Episode 9. I dedicate this to my dear friend Christina, a Z Records recording artist who I met in New York 40 years ago and who passed away last night. So Christina, this is for you.
I remember when I was a little girl, my mother set the house on fire. She was like that. I'll never forget the look on my father's face as he dragged me out of the building and onto the pavement. And I stood there shivering in my pajamas and watched the whole world go up in flames. And when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to a fire? Is that all there is?
Of all the punk bands that Renee and I used to go and see at the Roxy, the 100 Club or the Nashville, the Damned always seemed to be having the best time on stage. They were a cartoon punk band, like a new wave Screaming Lord Sutch and the Savages. It was really Brian James's band. He wrote all the material and played a low-slung Gibson SG guitar with a craggy, leather-faced cool. He always seemed to be a lot older than the other three, and I always imagined that he had tried out every other style of pop and got lucky with punk. Rats Gabies was an explosive pyrotechnic drummer from the Keith Moon School of Restraint. Ray Burns, also known as Captain Sensible, the bass player, and the most flamboyant of the bunch, always seemed to be a bit of a twat. It was the frontman and singer Dave Vanian who really caught the eye, though, on stage, with his white Nosferatu makeup, black eyeshadow and lipstick, and immaculate Adams Family tailoring. He was like a lovable, toothless vampire. He couldn't really sing a note, but he had a busload of energy and prowled the stage like a man possessed and really ripped it up. Off stage, typically, he was an absolute sweetheart, a shy, amiable, and embarrassed at his success, while Rat and Ray were totally brattish and obnoxious. Brian just hung out in the dressing room with his girlfriend, the American photographer Erica Eschenberg, and looked moody. I got to know Dave pretty well, and we used to hang out together whenever he was in London for a few days. The Damned toured a lot, and when he wasn't on the road, he still lived with his mum in Hemel Hempstead. He was a big fan of the Doctors of Madness and got along to see us whenever he could when we played around that part of the country. There used to be a lot of regular gigs up there, St. Albans City Hall, a club called Friars in Aylesbury, Hemel Hempstead Town Hall and so on. All used to be great audiences for us, and Dave came to them all. He was quite a bit younger than me, and I was surprised when he told me he was going to marry his girlfriend, the Gothic clothes designer, Laurie. I was even more surprised when they asked me to be his best man. It was not a role I'd ever taken before, but I agreed to do it anyway, and we all assembled at Acton Town Hall Registry Office on the 7th of September. I hadn't realised how strictly the dress code was still enforced in those days, and I was told that if I didn't wear a tie, I would not be allowed to be best man. Laurie was looking a bit anxious in her black lace and magenta wedding dress, and I didn't want to let her or Dave down, so when I saw a copy of Woman's Own lying around, I tore it into the appropriate shape of a tie and stuck it to my shirt under my chin with a bit of chewing gum. The ceremony went ahead, and the photos looked great. Most of the artists who were on the Damned's record label, Stiff Records, came along to the reception afterwards, as did the label owner Jake Rivera. Stiff were the first of the successful independent record labels, inspired by a combination of Rivera's marketing nous and the memorable record sleeves and graphic designs of the late Barney Bubbles. Dave's mum baked a wedding cake, topped extravagantly with two black roses, and along with Elvis Costello, Ian Dury, The Adverts and Nick Lowe and 75 others, Rini and I got really hammered. The reception was at Pete Watts's house and went on for 2 days before Dave and Laurie left for their honeymoon in a chauffeur-driven hearse.
I don't know why. I guess these things have gotta be.
1976 was a hectic year for the Doctors, We toured Holland 3 times, France twice, Sweden, Denmark, Belgium, Germany, Switzerland. And in addition, we played 86 gigs in the UK, including a big London show at the Shaftesbury Theatre. I was living the life I felt I was born to live, but for the most part, my feeling was, this sure beats working. But the constant travelling and uncompromising lifestyle was starting to get to me. While we were in France, I called Rini one morning and she was in tears on the other end of the line. I asked what was wrong and she said that both she and Gino were in the Royal Free Hospital. She was frantic. She explained that Gino had been diagnosed as suffering from infantile eczema, which the hot summer sun had aggravated, and he had constantly scratched his tortured skin in his sleep and it had become infected. His entire body was covered from head to toe with a virulent scarlet rash, which had blistered and ulcerated. It was heartbreaking to hear both of Eugene's condition and Rina's despair, and I felt so powerless, so far away, unable to comfort either of them for another 10 days when the dates were finished. She was staying at the hospital with him, trying to soothe him while also trying to do her own illustration work. It was an awful time. I put the phone down, stunned. Then I burst into tears. I realised for the first time I was probably suffering from exhaustion and I couldn't wait to get home. We played out the rest of the shows and they were great gigs, fueled by the desperation of someone who's on the point of total collapse. By the time I got back to London, Gina was on the road to recovery and I swapped places with Rini at the hospital for a couple of days to give her some time out. I needed the rest which staying at the hospital offered as well. The doctors and nurses were exemplary and treated Gino with extraordinary care and tireless attention. It put the hedonistic, self-obsessed lifestyle of a rock singer into a shameful perspective. With the release of Figments of Emancipation in September 1976, we were back on the road again, doing gigs, interviews, radio and TV. Punk was now the only game in town, and although many of the punk bands who were getting a lot of media attention were self-confessed fans of the doctors, The Damned, The Skids, The Adverts, Joy Division, Penetration, blah blah, we'd just been around for too long to be thought of as being part of this new explosion. We were an anachronism, neither old-style rock nor new-style punk. Timing is everything in the music business, and for reasons that were totally unforeseeable even 12 months ago, we were already starting to look old-fashioned. I was 25 years old, and I belonged to a previous generation. It occurred to me that this is how it must have felt for Uncle Stan and the Radio Revelers when the kids start screaming for the Beatles. I went to see The Clash at the ICA in London in October and became even more depressed. They were sensational. Joe Strummer barked, Mick Jones proud, and Paul Simonon was a true rock god with impossible cheekbones. Their spray-painted combat fatigue stage clothes made them look like heroic freedom fighters from the barricades of a future cultural war. The noise they made was like a B-52 bomber taking off with a full payload. Not a single word of the lyrics was decipherable, but the ritual of the experience took the audience to another communal place. In all honesty, I never really bought The Clash's politics, but boy did I buy their music. 25 years later, I feel that Tracy Emin's putative primitivism is only as authentic as the punk voice of Joe Strummer, Polystyrene or Johnny Rotten was in those days. No less so, but certainly no more. Her primitivism is artfully and cleverly enhanced, burnished and heightened. It plays to the gallery and waits for its disapproval, and it cunningly focuses on the elements that she wishes to use to shock us. Her truest talent is the sharpness of focus. Her work is conventional in its avowed unconventionality, but she has got it down pat, and in its own terms, it works supremely well. Despite the fact that the music press had moved wholesale into promoting punk rock, some of the critics were positive in their reviews of Figments of Emancipation. Phil McNeil in the New Music Express says, "The Doctors are unusual, inspired and intensely committed to their obscurantist, neurotic, horrific, desperately humanist view of inner city space. Their corporate understanding transcends structures." Sadly, the most original and influential rock critic of the day, Giovanni D'Adamo of Sounds magazine, was less enthusiastic. He demolished the record with a brilliant, typically minimalist, acerbic put-down. So boring, no vision, so self-same, no magic, so trivial, no aura, so eager, no action, so cloudy, no zip, so faceless, no freshness, etc. Before finishing with a coup de grace, so, no. That review hurt like hell. Never believe any performer who says bad reviews don't hurt. They're either liars or they can't read. It should be mentioned that the rock journalists who worked for one of the big three publications, the New Music Express, Sounds or Melody Maker, were enormously powerful and influential figures in the music industry at that time. A handful of them have the real capacity to make or break a band simply by writing a few pages of hyperbole. As well as Giovanni D'Adamo, the biggest names in rock journalism at that time were Nick Kent, John Ingham, Julie Burchill and Tony Parsons. The wonderful thing about this amphetamine aristocracy was that they had no more idea about what was really happening or what was truly substantial than any other Joe on the street. In their highly acclaimed critique of punk rock, The Boy Looked at Johnny, Burchill and Parsons, the Herod and Salome of punk, having sounded off endlessly about their understanding and empathy, pontificated as to who posterity would prove to be the most significant acts to come out of the movement. After much consideration, these two precocious pundits of punk came up with two names, Tom Robinson and Polystyrene. The cigar stays in the humidor, guys. I was so incensed by D'Adamo's review of Figments of Emancipation that I wrote him a scathing letter accusing him of being a careerist parasite and demanded that we meet to settle this like men. I hadn't really planned what I would do if he replied, so I was astonished when he telephoned and said that he'd enjoyed my letter so much more than my album and asked if we'd like to do an interview for Sounds. We met at Brian Morrison's office the following week, and by now Morrison had moved his office to Bruton Place behind Bond Street. A nervous but distinctly cool Giovanni D'Adamo set up his cassette recorder and we sat across the table from each other and waited to see who would blink first. He had the dark, sunken eyes and gaunt features of an enthusiastic and single-minded drug taker. His skin was ravaged by the pockmarks of early acne or some other condition. The Damned always openly referred to him as Pizza Face. Years later, my friend, the artist Brian Clark, who I met through Giovanni, told me his mother had taken him aside after meeting D'Adamo for the first time and said, with heartfelt concern, "Ooh, Brian, isn't it terrible what's happened to Lionel Blair?" To whom D'Adamo bore a passing resemblance. As we chatted, it slowly became apparent that we agreed on much more than we disagreed on, and that we shared a similar sense of humour and an almost identical set of heroes. We spent the entire afternoon together laughing at the scams we'd pulled, enthusing about this singer or that band, and we emerged into the Paddington evening as the commuters were heading home. Unfortunately, there was no way back from his album review, but the article he subsequently penned was contrite. Within a few weeks of that initial encounter, Giovanni, also known as Joe Varnish, second-generation Italian junkie and founder member of his own punk band, The Snivelling Shits, had become a very good friend. He had a quirky writing style and could turn his hand to anything. He'd written lyrics for the Japanese percussionist Stobu Yamashita. He'd written poems, short stories and journalism, all imbued with a highly original approach and a memorable wit. Despite the mixed reviews of the album, we continued a relentless touring schedule throughout the year. In the autumn, to promote Figments of Emancipation, we embarked on another tour of the UK, playing larger venues now, such as universities, top-ranked dance halls and some smaller concert halls across the country. We publicised the tour with a manifesto I wrote about pollution, corporate greed and the arms race. We took to the stage in blinding white light, white noise and smoke, wearing gas masks. We opened with main lines, "This is the place the rats come to die," and got gloomier, ending with a musical equivalent of a nuclear meltdown. It wasn't exactly an evening of dance music. We closed the tour on the 28th of November with the obligatory London showcase gig at the Shaftesbury Theatre, and it was a pretty good show. A lot of the kids who now had bands came along, and Dave Vanian of The Damned joined us on stage for an encore. It was a bit like being given the punk seal of approval. Wherever the Doctors played now, our support bands were wannabe punk rockers. In Scotland, we were supported by Johnny and the Self Abusers, who found rather more success after they changed their name to Simple Minds. They played a version of Waiting for the Man, which the chubby-faced singer Jim Kerr introduced with the words, "This song was written by Lou Reed and rewritten by Kid Strange." In Manchester at the Electric Circus, the warm-up band was Warsaw, who became Joy Division, then became New Order. In Newport, South Wales, a pimply youth came into our dressing room after a show and brazenly introduced himself as Steve Harrington. He was gushing and sycophantic and announced to whoever was listening that from this day forth, he was changing his name in honour of the band in general and me in particular. From now on, he announced to no one in particular, I will be known as Steve Strange. I really didn't give it another thought as he was ushered from the dressing room, but 3 or 4 years later, that night, and the lumpy visage would come back to haunt me. We played anywhere and everything. We played Mayballs and Deb parties from Nowhere to Knightsbridge. As a live band, the Doctors were pretty hot by now, and we had a loyal and committed following, but in commercial terms, it was just too small to sustain us. In review of one of our gigs at the renowned but now defunct Marquee Club in London's Wardour Street, which we sold out for 4 nights running, the New Musical Express said, "The blonde electric Narcissus figure of Peter Dilemma crashes into his kit in a relentless train time, and the Doctors slam into waiting. It moves at an exhilarating, demented gallop, and it's still as big a surprise as it was the first time I saw them to realise just how well this superficially superficial band can play." The music is all Kids. He writes post-Velvets, romantic, intellectual, virtually incomprehensible cinema verite of a blank generation from which his articulation disbars him, and a sophisticated paranoia casualties from whom his aggressive self-confidence distinguishes him. In November 1976, the record I considered to be the greatest single to come out of the punk rock genre was released. It wasn't by the Pistols or the Clash or the Buzzcocks, but by a highly literate poet from Kentucky who called himself Richard Hell. The record made with his band The Voidoids was entitled Blank Generation and captured the stuttering, frustrated nihilism of the punk ethos better than any other. Aside from the magnificently radical, angular music they made, it could be argued that Hell also invented punk fashion, wearing ripped t-shirts and spiky hair long before Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood recognised there was a buck to be made from selling it. With Blank Generation, Richard Hell kicked a hole in the cultural wall and the Sex Pistols stormed right through it. On December the 1st, the Pistols appeared on a national tea time TV show called Today, and established their career and created a legend. Following a 3-minute-long foul-mouthed assault on the hopelessly out-of-his-depth presenter Bill Grundy, by the following morning they were public enemy number one. By mid-December 1976, any band with a spiky haircut and a pair of PVC drainpipe trousers could get a deal, and the record companies showed their herd instinct once again, as packs of A&R men, still in their nylon tour jackets, scoured sweaty basement clubs like the Roxy, the Vortex or the Hope and Anchor, looking for all the world like FBI men setting up a sting on the Lower East Side. Even Giovanni D'Adamo's band, the Snivelling Shits, started more as a joke than a serious enterprise, had got a record deal and had released their double-sided cult classic Terminal Stupid and I Can't Come, to considerable critical acclaim. In their case, rather easy to come by. 3 of the 4 band members were rock journalists, so they wrote slavering reviews of their own records, often weeks before they'd even been recorded, and frequently awarded themselves a coveted Record of the Week accolade. They went on to record an extraordinarily verbose album, which featured what were possibly their best 2 songs, Bring Me the Head of Yukio Mishima and Is God a Man? In the year ending December 1976, we'd improved considerably on 1975 in our capacity to earn money from live gigs. We grossed over £25,000 in fees, but once again, There was a £10,000 shortfall against expenses. It meant that the record advance, which should have improved our lifestyle a little, we were still only drawing £35 a week as wages at this point, went towards servicing our debt to Brian Morrison. In March, we played an unpublicised show at the Speakeasy Club, while in the audience, Sid Vicious, who had recently replaced Glenn Matlock as bass player with the Sex Pistols in an atypically bloodless coup, took increasingly unfocused swings at anyone who was passing. I like to think that this was the night I saved Sid Vicious's life, since later that evening, as we came off stage, I walked into the gents' toilet and was confronted by the gruesome sight of Sid with a needle in his arm, nodding off as he sat on the lavatory, the door wide open, his trademark leather jacket in a heap next to him. He was dribbling and his grey flesh looked like dough. Nancy Spungen, the American groupie, whom he would eventually marry and murder, threw up on the floor in the adjacent cubicle, oblivious to what was going on with Sid. Already aware, through reports in the press, of the legendary unpredictability of his temper, I woke him by slapping his face hard twice, and as his eyes flickered open and seemed to roll back in his head, I fled before he could throw a punch back. As I left, I heard him bellow the word, "Can't," after me. On the 7th of June, the Pistols hired a boat on the River Thames called the Queen Elizabeth and had their own unofficial Jubilee party. It was a hoot. The band, selected journalists and hangers-on were marshalled onto the boat by a chirpy McLaren, intent on mischief, like Fletcher Christian hand-picking his own mutinous crew. The Pistols tried to play a set but had their power cut off, and when they were forced to return to their mooring by the river police, Malcolm was ecstatic. The band only had to get out of bed to ensure a slew of newspaper and television coverage. Reenie and I went to see all the American bands who came over, and they were frequently fantastic double-billed affairs, where we got to glimpse firsthand what all the press fuss was about. We loved the Ramones at the Roundhouse, but it was really their co-stars, the Talking Heads, who blew us away. Can't seem to face up to the facts. I'm tense and nervous, can't relax. Can't sleep, bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire. Psycho killer, qu'est-ce que c'est? Fucking fire, fucking fucking fire, fire better. Run, 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 run away. They were so weird, so edgy, so artistic, so autistic. They were right up our street. Similarly, we went to see a great New York double bill at Hammersmith Odeon, which featured the pure pop of Debbie Harry's Blondie and the crystalline lyricism of Tom Verlaine's Television. All those bands were guitar-driven, but with a diversity of sound and approach, which was much more adventurous than their British counterparts. British punks were all attitude, they acted dumb, and they made a virtue of their musical incompetence. The Americans could play. Tom Verlaine never acted dumb, nor did Talking Heads leader David Byrne. With the exception of the Ramones, who were happy to be characterised as pinheads, none of these US bands fitted into an English concept of punk rock, but they sat easily in the latest generic pigeonhole, New Wave. Even the original American wild boy Iggy Pop, who had released his first album with his band The Stooges some 10 years earlier, found his career given an unexpected boost by the tributes paid to him by the British punk rockers. I saw him play a show at the Rainbow Theatre in London's Finsbury Park, supported by the Adverts, who by now were good friends of mine. T.V. Smith's girlfriend and bass player, Gay Advert, punk's first pin-up and no stranger to the joys of amphetamine herself, listened wide-eyed with admiration as Iggy told me he'd been up for 13 days straight. I was impressed. His claim would have stretched my credulity to breaking point had he not looked so wasted that one could easily have believed that he'd been up for 13 weeks straight. By 1978, Polydor had all but dropped us. Contractually, we still had one more album to record for them, but we knew, and they knew, that it was just a bank raid. Their energies were elsewhere. They were now enjoying some success with three big punk bands, Susie and the Banshees, The Jam, and the crudely drawn cartoon punk rock of Sham 69. They also had just released a double soundtrack album from a 1977 movie called Saturday Night Fever, which was beginning to shift a few copies. It went on to sell over 30 million. The Doctors had finished the previous accounting year on something of a high note. We'd made a touring profit. Having grossed £29,227.91 in appearance fees, we had paid out a mere £29,206.90 in expenses. We had made money. £21 and a penny, to be precise, between four of us. That was £5.20 each, or 10p a week. This was the first time I realised the wonderful world of show business is unfair. Unlike other professions, you're not rewarded simply for sticking around. The music business thrives on novelty. If you stick around too long without success, you'll notice everyone in the business starts edging away from you like you're a bad smell or a contagious disease. Polydor was contractually bound to give us another big advance for the third album, and Morrison wasn't about to let them off that particular hook. I'd written some very good songs for the new record, both alone and with T.V. Smith, the writer and singer from the adverts, who'd recently had a big hit with their quirky, darkly amusing song Gary Gilmore's Eyes, and I was keen to give the thing one last shot. We went back into Majestic Studios, where we'd recorded the first album, and produced the record ourselves with Hobbsy, our sound man at the controls. In some ways, it was a reward for Hobbs' uncomplaining loyalty to the band through all the shit and the deprivations. We thought it might help him make the transition to a less arduous side of the business, and since we really feared for his health sometimes, we thought that could only be to his advantage. The songs on the third album, which I entitled somewhat vaingloriously Sons of Survival, were actually some of the best songs I've ever written. The overall feel of the album is apocalyptic. We all knew it was going to be our last, but we never mentioned it out loud. The title track, Sons of Survival, a rant against record company politics and big business machinations, was driven by a nagging one-note riff from Urban Blitz's violin and a goose-stepping bass line from Stoner.
Here, where the losers wear medals and nightshirts and talk revolution, but could never let go. Watch executions and still they are technical. Teach elocution but could never say no.
Chunky guitar chords underline the vocal, and I even played a half-decent guitar solo on top. Back from the Dead was a song I'd written with T.V. Smith, one of several we'd written together over the preceding year. I think he came up with the title and we wrote the lyrics and music jointly. It was a furiously fast song with lyrics spat out over a high-octane track. The adverts recorded the song themselves on their second album, but if anything, our version was even more punked up than theirs.
Back from the Dead!
Triple Vision was one of the best songs I ever wrote for the Doctors, and I still like that song today. I especially like the residue of proud Nietzschean atheism and Marxist dialecticism. I even play it acoustically occasionally, and it works, a sure sign of a good song.
Down the street is a man who's been blinded by visions of prisons for some and for others' hotels. Could it be what you call evolution? It's nothing much more than a multiplication of cells. I talked about the evils of bad lonely millions. May take all the bones of it seems I'm never alone. But TV stays on one.
The song Network was inspired partly by the recently released film of that name about a TV anchorman who has an ongoing nervous breakdown on screen and sees his viewing figures rocket because of it. And partly, it was my cryptic goodbye note to the rest of the band. I'm through with the piecework, I'm through with the network.
Jean says, is it true what I heard, that we're leaving? Gotta go now, I can find nothing left to believe in. And although we may learn, we can never return. And the things we don't need, we might just as well burn. I'm through with the piecework, I'm through with the network.
The album also included a punk-influenced song, Bulletin, which was a tirade against the absorption of punk rock into the multinational mainstream. When the record was finished, Urban Blitz announced he'd had enough and was quitting. For me, it was quite a relief. He'd started to freak out on a personal level. He became unmanageable on a one-to-one basis, but the thing was, he was so screwed up, he'd put all his neurosis onto this new record and made it really edgy. As soon as he'd done his tracks and his overdubs, that was it. He was off. He wasn't interested in hanging around for the mixing. As I said before, we never had been a particularly close band socially, but there had always been a tacit relationship that was based on a common focus. The focus went for him, and it got to the point where he was just turning up for the gigs and going home after them. Stoner, Peter and myself talked about what we wanted to do, and we agreed to give it a little while longer. We were reluctant to completely pull the plug because it felt like there was unfinished business, not least because we'd made a record of which we were all quite proud and we wanted at least to promote it and give it one more chance. We decided to give it 6 more months. The three of us really developed in that period. I was interested in filling the gaps that Urban left with tapes and electronics. It had been explored so little and it was what I was always intended the Doctors to progress into. I thought that where a fourth instrument was demanded, we could use sound, pure sound, noise effects, sound effects, electronics in an abstract way. A few weeks later, the Damned broke up, not for the first time and not for the last, and their singer, Dave Vanian, called me to tell me that he was at loose end. It occurred to me that it might be fun to get Dave on tour with us as a second frontman and singer. I didn't mind sharing my limelight with him, as I knew we would bounce off each other on stage and that he would certainly galvanise us into positive action. We knew, too, that he would attract some of the Damned's following to our shows. It was really a last throw of the dice. Polydor stumped up a small amount of cash to put us into a studio with Dave to record a new song that I'd just written with TV Smith called Don't Panic England. We were panicking now. Dave and I shared the vocals. It was a pretty good song, but it was all just too late. The song was never released and Dave only did a handful of shows with us. I told Giovanni that I thought we would fold up the band before the end of the year, and he thought it was the best thing to do. You got such talent, he told me, you're bound to make it when you find the right vehicle. I think it was while playing a rainy outdoor festival in Chelmsford that I finally decided it was over. Not just for us, but for punk too. It was a dismal day, brightened only by a backstage visit by Rod Tyner, leader of the MC5, one of my great heroes back in the late 60s. He was wildly excited about the set that we'd just played and wondered if we could do some work together at some stage. My head was elsewhere, and I never even took his number. Doctors of Madness played their final show at the Music Machine in Camden Town, 3.5 years after we'd signed with Brian Morrison and Justin de Villeneuve. Cabaret Voltaire supported. It was a miserable gig, in a venue that seemed to have been sucked dry of all joy. We intended to play a very long set, taking in most of our favourite songs from 3 albums. It was as much for old time's sake and as a sense of putting those songs to rest. We opened up with a 10-minute long new song called Trouble that I'd written some time back but had never done with the Doctors. It kicked the set off with howling, agonised maelstrom of feedback, the rhythm slowly insinuating itself and then asserting itself until it was insistent, lobotomised jackhammer. For a 3-piece, we made the most terrifying racket that night. The song ends with one of my more modest observations. If genius was murder, I'd end up in the chair. I've got a mind like Bertrand Russell, and I dance like Fred Astaire. T.V. Smith joined us on stage for 2 songs that he and I had written, Making Machines and The Last Human Being in the World, plus a song called Who Cries for Me that I'd recently finished. I remember we also did a killer version of Lou Reed's Velvet Underground classic What Goes On, which we first tried out in Berlin. But there was no fun that night, no fun in the gig for any of us. We were so strung out on speed and booze that it felt like the people in the cavernous arena had just come to pay their respects to a corpse. Many of the critics reviewing that show took the opportunity to give the corpse one last good kicking just to make sure it was dead. The music journalists Paul Morley and John Savage were 2 of the most vicious cadaver abusers. The 3.5 years since the Cabbage Patch had been a bumpy ride full of excitements and disappointments and unfulfilled dreams. We'd got tantalisingly close, we'd been to the top of the Candy Mountain and we'd seen the land of milk and honey, but we had been denied entry. We'd somehow gone from being ahead of our time to being passé, without ever spending a single night between the crisp, clean white linen sheets of being now, from dynamos to dinosaurs.